Good afternoon. Please be seated. We are here this afternoon in the matter of Restroom Facilities versus Kaufman. It is case number 55765. As you can see, Justice Pickering is here in Carson City with me. Our Chief Justice Cherry is with us at the RJC, our Southern Nevada courtroom, and he will be participating fully in both argument considerations here today and post-argument conferencing. So if you hear a voice that seems to be coming from nowhere during the course of your presentations here today, I would ask you to take a look at your monitors. I'm sorry, do they have monitors that they can see? Yes, because it may very well be Justice Cherry asking the question. And with that, are counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well. Mr. McAuliffe.
May it please the court, counsel. I am Jack McAuliffe, and I'd like to speak, if I may, for 5 minutes and reserve 10 minutes of my time. Restroom Facilities Limited is a Nevada corporation. It was incorporated in 1988 by Charles and William Harper, who are two attorneys in Reno. And in 1991, Russell Hawley purchased all of the stock in that company. At that time, Mr. Kaufman was the president of the corporation, and Mr. Hawley entered into an oral agreement with Mr. Kaufman to continue his employment as president of the corporation at a salary of $60,000 a year. And the issue that we're here today is whether or not a 6-year statute of limitations or a 4-year statute of limitations should be applied to his claim for unpaid salary. There are NRS 11.190 requires for a 6-year statute of limitation that the agreement must be founded upon an instrument in writing. There are two Nevada cases, Stevens versus McCormick at 50 Nevada, 1928 case, and El Ranco versus New York, Meat and Provisions, 88 Nevada 111. Both cases discuss a variety of cases from other jurisdictions, but all those cases, among other things, conclude that the written instrument that would be the basis for a 6-year statute of limitation must be an agreement, not remotely or ultimately, but immediately. And there is simply no such instrument in this case. In the El Ranco versus New York Meat and Provision case, the documents in question were invoices that had been signed by a representative of the El Rancho Hotel, and the court concluded that those were sufficient, although Judge Thompson dissented. But the conclusion in the El Ranco case was that in the absence of signed documentation, our ruling may be different, and such situation will be considered when it arises. And I guess maybe this is the case. But again, referring to Stevens versus McCormick, again, they talked about instruments of writing executed by the parties. The El Ranco case, again, they talked about signature being an essential part of this. And in addition, at the conclusion of amending the judgment, Mr. Kaufman was awarded prejudgment interest on his claim. But the appellant in this case was not awarded prejudgment. And we believe that NRS 17.130 mandates that there be prejudgment interest, at least dating from the date of service of the complaint. And if I may, I reserve the balance of my time, unless the court has any questions.
Chief, any questions?
No.
Very well.
Thank you.
Mr. Maloof?
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors. And Justice Cherry, good afternoon to you. My name is Lee Moloff, Moloff and Vol Firm, representing the respondent, Mr. Kaufman, in this case. Mr. McAuliffe skimmed over the facts very quickly, and I think it would be helpful if I fill in a few of the loopholes. It is correct that from 1991 to 2002, Mr. Kaufman acted as the president of RFL and was an employee of RFL. There really is no dispute in this case that he was, in fact, an employee, and I think that's important when we get to some of the issues that I'll get to in a moment. During that 11-year period that he was president, the company was hemorrhaging all the time. The cash flow was horrible. I don't think there's any dispute about that. And because of that, Mr. Kaufman did not take his salary every year when he could have. And so there was an accrual of unpaid salary over that 11-year period. However, from time to time, he would take loans and advances and charge personal expenses on company credit cards so that he could live while he was foregoing the salary that he was entitled to. He was fired from that position in October of 2002. That immediately followed in December of 2002 with a lawsuit filed by RFL, now owned by Mr. Russell Hawley. In that lawsuit, they sought to recover. There was a number of different causes of action, non-compete and other things like that. But basically, what's relevant for today's purposes, they sought to recover from Mr. Kaufman a repayment of the notes and the monies and the advances that he had taken during that period of time for his unpaid salary and other issues as well. But again, for today's purposes, that's what happened. As an affirmative defense to the counterclaim, RFL asserted that Mr. Kaufman could not go back in time, that it was barred by the statute of limitations, without specifying what statute of limitations was applicable. There was a trial on all these issues. There were some other related cases that were consolidated, and there was a trial that took place in the summer of 2005. That was followed by a written findings of fact. It was tried to the court. It was followed by written findings of fact, conclusions of law, and a judgment that was entered in October of 2005. And in that judgment, there were a lot of these different claims back and forth, offset and against each other. Judge Adams ruled that the statute of limitations was not applicable. There was no statute of limitations applicable because under the doctrine of equitable recoupment, there was no reason that you couldn't go back all the way as long as that doctrine was applicable. And Judge Adams found it to be applicable so that the salary that was owed to Mr. Kaufman going all the way back to 91 could be used and offset against the claims that RFL had against Mr. Kaufman, which gets us to the statute of limitations. That decision was appealed by RFL. This court ruled against Mr. Kaufman and ruled that the doctrine of equitable recoupment was not applicable because the claims were not logically connected sufficiently to invoke the doctrine of recoupment. And this court sent it back to Judge Adams to determine what the appropriate amount of salary that should be offset would be. And there was a minor issue dealing with the calculation of interest on two promissory notes as well. That gets us to the issue of the 4 versus 6 year statute of limitations and what we have. Mr. McAuliffe correctly pointed out that the most recent Nevada case on this that this court has issued is the Elranco decision, which I'll get to in a moment. But the statute itself, 11.1901B or 2A, reads, and I think it's important, that an action upon a contract, obligation, or liability founded upon an instrument in writing will be 6 years. That's NRS 11.1901B. So the operative language is an action upon obligation or liability founded upon an instrument in writing. Now, before I get to the analysis that I'll get to, and I see I need to hurry up a little bit here because time is running short already, I think there's two other arguments that I think this court needs to hear. One is the doctrine of judicial estoppel, I think, is applicable to this matter, and this court could short-circuit the analysis on the four-year versus six-year if it were to rule that RFL is judicially estopped. And the doctrine of judicial estoppel, briefly, the elements...
I think it would be more profitable to address the writings on which you contend this qualifies for the longer six-year statute rather than judicial estoppel.
Okay. I'll be happy to do that. We also have, however, the doctrine of judicial admission, and I think that's important because they said right in the amended verified complaint that there was a written employment agreement, and they attached a copy of it.
But that was the non-compete agreement,
It was
right?
The non-compete agreement, but nonetheless it had language in it that said, whereas employee, which was Mr. Kaufman, wants to work here, and whereas employer wants him to work here, we need to enter into this. It was clearly a writing, an instrument that was in writing, that evidenced this relationship. Let's look at the facts of our case. What we have in front of us, what is part of the record, even though we don't have the transcript, Mr. McAuliffe did not put the transcript in, and I think that is a key omission on his part. We don't have all the testimony that took place at trial, which would also establish that there were writings. But what we do have is we have five checks. They're part of the record. They were payroll checks that were paid to Mr. Kaufman. We also have 3 minutes of the board of directors meetings for RFL. We have a memorandum that was prepared by the president of RFL after Mr. Kaufman left that evidenced the existence of other documents in her testimony. So there are a lot of writings in this case that will be that I'll discuss.
The memorandum was prepared post litigation, correct?
No, the memorandum was prepared before the 2005 trial.
But it was prepared after the lawsuit was initiated, correct?
It was prepared after the lawsuit was initiated. Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
And after the counterclaims had been filed?
I presume so. I presumed it was prepared. I don't know the exact date it was prepared, but I'm going to presume it was prepared prior to trial and after the pleadings were all joined.
So how could the action as to that writing be founded in action upon a contract founded upon an instrument in writing when the instrument in writing did not come into being until after the suit was initiated and the claim made?
All of the other documents that I'm talking about were created prior to the lawsuit being filed.
I agree with you. I'm just trying to take them document by document, and I was going in reverse order.
Well, the import of that document wasn't so much the document itself. It was the testimony that Penny Mello gave when she testified how she prepared that document. And she prepared that document from ledger sheets and other pieces of paper upon which that document was based. And all of the other pieces of paper that she testified were in existence were done before the lawsuit was ever.
So the best evidence are those other documents, not, in fact, this memorandum that was created once you were well into litigation.
I'm sorry, Justice?
So the best evidence of all of what is contained in this lately created memorandum are the documents that were otherwise, I presume, the best evidence and therefore admitted at the time of trial.
I'm assuming they were admitted at the time of trial, too, but I don't know. I don't want to misrepresent anything to the court. I don't know what was or wasn't.
So we can summarily regard this memorandum, essentially, in our determination.
Well, again, we've got signed checks and signed board of directors meetings that took place later. If the court doesn't want to consider that document, I don't think it needs to in coming to the decision that I think this court should come to, which is to follow the holding of El Ranco. And clearly the checks are signed documents, the board of directors meetings minutes are signed documents evidencing. Let's talk about, I was going to talk about these other cases, the two Texas cases, which I think are very important, the Kirby case as well as the Jackson versus Paul Sell Lumber case, upon which this court relied heavily in coming to its decision in El Ranco. And again, The documents in El Ranco were these delivery receipts, simple delivery receipts that were signed at the El Rancho Hotel when New York Meat Company would drop off their meat. They would sign these slips evidencing the amount of the product that was delivered and the prices for that product. They weren't contracts. They were just delivery receipts. And the court in El Ranco, I'd like to read some of the excerpts from El Ranco. And it's talking about the Jackson v. Pulsell Lumber Texas case. And by the way, the Texas statute is more strict than the Nevada statute. The Texas statute said it's not founded upon an instrument in writing. The Texas statute says founded upon a contract in writing. And so the Nevada statute is liberal and has been considered liberal in this El Ranco decision. That state has concluded, referring to Texas, in Jackson v. Pulsell Lumber Company, I'll leave out the site, that signed writings such as appear in this case unquestionably acknowledge the existence of a set of facts for which the law implies an obligation to pay. And that being true, the obligation sued on is founded upon a written contract within the meaning of the Texas limitation statute. The language, the existence of a set of facts from which the law implies an obligation to pay. What we have here are checks. If that doesn't evidence and the existence of a set of facts from which the law can imply an obligation to pay a salary, I don't know what does. The board of directors meetings evidence the fact that Mr. Kaufman is the president of this corporation. And as the Kirby case, the Texas case in Kirby pointed out, in employment cases, you needn't show exactly what the salary is. That can be proven with extraneous evidence, even parole evidence in some cases. So what we have here is board of directors meetings, three of them that are part of the record before this court, as well as these checks.
And you're talking on the board of directors minutes about they're in the record at 146, 106, and 120.
I'm sorry, what are you
referring to? I'm just trying to make sure I have what you're basing your writing claims on. Your board of directors minutes are the
directors minutes are in volume 3 of the appendix, starting at
551?
Yes.
Through 554.
And the checks start at 545 in the same volume.
Okay. What about the board of directors minutes? How are they the proper basis for a claim that this employment relationship is founded upon an instrument in writing?
In the Kirby case, that was based on the minutes of the what they called the commissioner's court in Texas, which I think was the Board of County Commissioners, is I think what it talked about. They hired a replacement treasurer. They acknowledged it in the minutes of that board, and there's references in the case that it would be analogous to a board of directors meetings of a private corporation. And if those writings were sufficient in Kirby, which formed the basis of the decision in Jackson v. Pulsell, which was a very strong, persuasive decision in the El Ranco case, I think that this court can easily rely on that authority and that decision for that proposition, especially in light of the fact that this statute has been deemed to be interpreted by the El Ranco and even the earlier case to be liberally construed. The El Ranco decision talks about the legislative history of the statute, how it was adopted from a California statute and how the California decisions on that statute gave it a liberal reading. The Nevada statute is very liberal compared to other state statutes. It doesn't require an actual written contract, and that's why we're here today. I think that this court should follow the El Ranco decision. You would have to, in essence, reverse El Ranco to rule that the evidence we have here today that liability founded upon an instrument in the receipts that El Ranco found sufficient. All they were was a three carbon copy receipt slip that somebody signed when they dropped off the meat. That was it. that was enough to invoke the six-year statute under El Ranco. I have 20 seconds. Let me just address quickly the prejudgment interest issue. With all due respect to Mr. McCullough, he is wrong. There is prejudgment interest. What happened is Mr. McAuliffe won in 2005, basically won, even though there were offsets allowed by Judge Adams. He won. He prepared the judgment form that was entered in October of 2005. It did apply interest to the two promissory notes all the way to the date going back to 91, I think, on one of the promissory notes. It didn't apply interest to prejudgment interest to the other claims that went back and forth. He appealed from that. He didn't raise the issue then. It gets remanded. He didn't raise it even when we had that hearing before Judge Adams. He didn't raise it till after that. He clearly has waived it. Besides the waiver, he got prejudgment interest. If you look at the amended judgment, it provides prejudgment interest from 2005 to 2009 for all of the claims that he prevailed on. And he got prejudgment interest on the notes that all the way back to when, going back to 91. So he got all the prejudgment interest he's entitled to. So if there was any more prejudgment interest, it would be interest, prejudgment interest on prejudgment interest.
Thank you, Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. McCullough.
As far as the interest is concerned, in the original judgment, Judge Adams announced his decision from the bench. He asked me to draw a judgment in accordance with what he had said from the bench, and I did just that. No prejudgment interest was allowed to either side, and both sides received judgments, although the ultimate net judgment was in favor of RFL. Neither side appealed that particular issue, and the case was then remanded, and once it was remanded, then Mr. Kaufman was asking for interest, and before the I don't believe that there has been any waiver. A couple things that I need to speak to, and counsel cites, El Ranco cited Jackson versus Falls Hill Lumber Company, the Texas cases, and this court noted signed writings such as appear in this case, and we don't have any signed writings in this case.
But he, could you address his point that the checks, the register copies of the checks evidence the exact employment relationship that he's seeking to enforce, and that they're directly analogous to the invoices in El Rancho, although misspelled El Ranco, and therefore we're bound by that El Rancho decision. We'd have to overrule it to credit your position given those checks, as I understand his argument, just focusing on the checks.
Well, I don't dispute, and I've never disputed, that he was hired orally at $60,000 a year. And those checks simply represent what the oral agreement was. And although counsel continues to tell us that Mr. Kaufman took loans and advances from RFL, Judge Adams found that what he did was a breach of his fiduciary duty, which is fraud. And this court has affirmed Judge Adams in that particular finding. But he says he didn't take salary, but he took loans and draws, and that isn't what they were at all. And he is right that the initial pleadings, the claim for unpaid salary was made. The affirmative defense of statute of limitations was pleaded, and certainly were at issue continuously throughout this case. And eventually, after remand, then Judge Adams had to address that particular issue. But one thing that Mr. Moloff did not address is a signed agreement of some sort. And since we're talking about an employment situation, I think we would, the only thing we're talking about would be a signed employment agreement, and there is no such thing. If there were, it would be part of the record, and there is no such thing here. In all cases, also, as I've indicated, require a written instrument, not remotely or ultimately, but immediately. And again, he was hired by Mr. Hawley in, I believe it was August of 1991, and he continued in that position until he was fired by Mr. Hawley in October of 2002. As far as the minutes are concerned, that are addressed here, one of those meetings was January 25, 1995. One is dated June 10, 1990, and the other is April 28, 1991. And none of them purport to acknowledge the terms or conditions or anything of the sort. They acknowledge that Mr. Kaufman presided at the meeting as president, and we don't dispute that he was president. But that's not the issue that's before the court. And the issue before the court is there an instrument in writing signed by the person to be charged? Or if we're going to, again, look at El Ranco, we also need to look at the concluding language that in the absence of signed documentation, our ruling may be different, and such situation will be considered when it arises. And all the things that Mr. Moloff has discussed, not one single item is a signed document. And unless the court has any questions.
I do on that point. So addressing the writing, the checks, which are register copies, are not signed. Is that your point, that that's how you distinguish El Rancho from this case? Because these checks were not signed?
No. The distinction in the El Rancho case is they were invoices. They stated what was being delivered. They stated what the price was. And they were signed by a representative of El Ranco. A representative of Mr. Hawley never signed any of these checks. And Mr. Hawley was 100% owner of the company. He's the one that hired Mr. Kaufman by an oral agreement, and he fired him. And there's never been any contention in this case that there's been a violation of an employment agreement or anything of that sort. And in this case, there simply is no signed documentation.
Ranko
says that question remains open.
Thank you, Mr. Maloof. Thank you, Mr. McAuliffe. Mr. McAuliffe, I'm sorry. Justice Cherry, Chief, any questions before I submit the matter?
No, Justice Sina.
Thank you all for your participation here today. This matter will stand submitted.